I'm going to go ahead and start the committee. We're short a few members, but we have quite a bit to accomplish today. And we're going to start out with Representative Dabney, who's bringing us a hostile and mortgage foreclosure. We don't quite have our quorum, Representative Dabney, but we'll start, and maybe you could start by beginning to explain the bill, take us through the bill, and then we'll, as soon as we get a quorum, we'll move it and
all right.
And go forward. And I'm not sure if you have any amendments to it, but do you have any amendments to this bill? It's all there. That's about 3346.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and members. House File 3346 was brought to me by the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. They support foreclosure prevention counseling across the state, and current law allows for financial assistance to be part of the package of services that they provide for homeowners in crisis. And that financial assistance is capped currently in statute at a maximum of $5,500 per individual or family, and can be used for mortgage payments, property taxes, utilities, insurance, and the like. Now, this money can either be public funds that we've appropriated or private funds that MHFA has secured from lenders or others who might be interested in supporting this work and supporting the housing market. This bill restructures the cap on financial assistance, whether it's grant or loan, to be rather than a fixed cap of $5,500, to instead be a cap of 110% of, and let me get to the technical language here, 110% of the greater of the state or metropolitan statistical area median monthly owner cost multiplied by 6, allowing us not to have to revisit this issue in future years as home values and mortgage payments change. With me today is Tanya Orr from the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and I'd like to turn the presentation over to her at this time, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you.
There's just a couple of things I wanted to point out. We're trying to use for the reason that we're asking for the increase in the cap is that we've been told by a lot of financial counselors or foreclosure prevention counselors that monthly mortgage payments multiplied by 6 exceed the $5,500. And therefore, they're not able to help families who maybe had a temporary loss of income, can maintain their mortgage payments, but need to catch up. And that's exactly what this money is intended to do, but they can't use it because it has to resolve the crisis if the amount that they owe exceeds $5,500 and not be able to resolve the crisis, and then they don't make the loan. So we thought it was counterproductive to have a cap that was then preventing us from doing exactly what we wanted to do, which was to preserve homeownership for a lot of families. This cap was last changed in 2001. Rather than come back every 2 years, we thought it made more sense to look at some objective standard and have that built into the law. We're very fortunate now that we have the American Community Survey, we can have an annual adjustment to this number. This year, the number would rise to $10,718 for the metro area and $9,478 for Greater Minnesota. We are unaware of any objections to this increase in cap. As I said, foreclosure counselors have been talking to us about increasing cap for a while now. We also recently received a $500,000 award from a financial institution specifically for these foreclosure prevention loans. So it's essentially doubling the amount of money that's available. And one of the things that the financial institution asked us was to increase the cap. They also recognized the cap was preventing people from getting help. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I have a question first of all. Which financial institution did this come
from? Marquette.
Marquette Bank?
Yes.
And it's $500,000?
Yes.
And do they have any restrictions on where it can be applied geographically? Or?
No, they would prefer a preference for families and a preference for the metro area because I think that's their general service area.
Any other questions? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Dabney. I know we had talked on the House floor last year when you brought this bill forward, and I believe I signed on to it at that point. I thought it was a good program in a critical time, but I was telling Ms. Orr that my niece ran into this issue over the summer, and because you had brought that bill forward and we'd gotten it through, I said, well, there must be a venue that kind of addresses this. In fact, her husband had lost a job for about 3 or 4 months. They got behind, and I'll name the bank, Wells Fargo, because the peanuts do it to me.
Maybe you have a glass of water.
No, I'm fine. I'm
Madam Chair, is this a peanut-free committee?
Maybe it should be.
My office should be too. But Wells Fargo has deemed a reputation for being a predatory lender, and this was, in fact, one of the issues that came up with my niece. They were unwilling to negotiate. As we went into this process, I asked her about the possibility for this, and she went to the particular person that was supposed to be doing this, and I guess it was a regional where they were awarded regional grants, and those monies had run out. My concern for this provision is if we're giving them a finite amount of money and we increase the cap on this, then do we run the risk of serving fewer people with more money? And I guess that would be one of the questions I'd like to raise. The other would be, Madam Chair, would be, is, are these grants for low-interest loans?
Madam Chair, I'd like to defer those questions over to Ms. Hora. She's more authoritative representative.
On the question of whether these are grants or loans, they are what we call deferred loans. So they are loans, and they are deferred until the property is no longer your principal place of business, or your principal place of residence. So they are 0%. You don't pay them back until you sell the house, essentially. So it's a loan, and we get actually about $200,000 biennium in repayment. So we are able to supplement the appropriation with, we're able to recycle some of the money. But we don't put a burden on the homeowner to pay us back until they've sold the home. And if they don't have equity in the home, to pay us back. On the question of whether this will result in fewer people being served, it's possible that it would, although this week we received this $500,000, so that's going to make the difference. It will result in at least as many people, if not more, being
served.
This one.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Being an elected official, I'm in the kind of the unique position of being able to bash on some institutions here, which I don't mind doing when they do this type of thing. And I think Wells Fargo ought to pay attention to some of the goodwill that has been done by this other bank. And instead of putting a squeeze on customers, try and work with the customers. Hopefully a Wells Fargo rep is here. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, I think Wells Fargo, I'm not sure about some of the other banks are part of this. Called the Hope Alliance, and having to do with foreclosure prevention. It's kind of a new initiative I heard a little bit about the other day. Are you familiar with this? And I think the idea is to encourage them to actually work with their customers, and I think we're hearing that at the federal level too. So I think your advice is timely, and hopefully some of that's there to take effect. Okay. Is there another comment? Oh, Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question about the market today. We got some kind of unique things going on. The loan-to-value ratios are just going totally off the charts. And the reasons that people are experiencing foreclosure today are multiple, and they're more complex than they were, I think, at the time that we kind of initiated this program. So what kind of criteria are we using so that this money is going to people who have a chance? As opposed to just going to people who are, we know they're going to fail.
Madam Chair, that's exactly what the criteria is. This loan has to resolve the crisis. So if you can't afford on an ongoing basis to make your monthly payment, we're not going to make you a loan to catch up. Because that's really just a risk management. It's not keeping you in a hole. So the loan is to keep you in your home. If you're in a situation where your rate has adjusted and you can't make the payment, the CalPERS will try and help negotiate a change in the rate so that you're getting two sorts of assistance. You're getting the counseling assistance to see if you can manage the situation so that you can stay in your home. Here's what it takes, or part of what it takes here is a loan, some cash, then that's what this money is available for. If no amount of cash is really going to be able to keep you in the house, then we're not going to provide this. So financial assistance, and you will get counseling to try and put your property up for sale or rent it out or something like that.
Follow up, Madam Chair. I think I understand that, I guess, but you're talking more about the cash flow. I'm talking about the loan to equity ratio. If you got a $150,000 loan on a house and now it's worth $90,000, even if they can cash flow the $150,000 loan, there's a question as to whether or not it's wise to, you know, not let the crisis just happen and let everything adjust. And I guess that's my question how do we address that situation where somebody might be capable of making it work, but what's the incentive to work that hard to pay off a loan if your equity is only $90,000 in the house?
Madam Chair, Representative Eastman, you know, we've really struggled with this because we've looked at whether the Housing Finance Agency, a couple of years ago, the legislature gave us authority to refinance mortgages for homeowners. And we've really looked seriously over the last year and spent a lot of time looking at what sort of refinancing product we could offer that would work. Several housing finance agencies across the country have put together refinancing products, and they have not been successful. Hardly anybody has taken advantage of the offer. And one of the big problems is this, what is referred to as being upside down. And that really, the only way that we can figure out how to address that problem is to make up the gap. You know, if your mortgage is $150 and the house is only worth $100, you've got a $50,000 gap. We don't have enough money to do that. We have not, quite frankly, come up with a good solution to that problem. I think that we're all hoping that this is a temporary situation and that property values will right, and if you can hang on for a couple of years, you'll at least get back up to what you owe.
Just one more follow-up answer. And I think this goes to the issue that Representative Severson was talking about. Is if that, in fact, is the case, I mean, I that's the intent, and that's how I understand this is supposed to work. However, if that isn't the case, then the beneficiaries, once again, are the financial institutions, because they're just going to get more money before they foreclose on the house. So, I think that we kind of got a fine line to walk here, at some point, the market, as cruel as the market is, has to work if we're going to ever see the upside-down positioning change. So I guess that's just a caution. I think the idea here and the intent is definitely a good thing, and I support that, but I just think there's some real pitfalls in going down this road that may or may not solve the problem that we're trying to solve.
Madam Chair? Let me put Representative Eastman this in a broader context. We've always talked about the assistance to specific individual homeowners. I would argue that the market is sensitive to what is happening with individual homeowners, but also in the aggregate. And if the house next to mine goes into foreclosure, that reduces my property value and helps to create the very upside-down situation that you and the Zora have both spoken to. If we can provide assistance to individual homeowners to keep them in their homes and stabilize their situation, we not only help that individual, we help to stabilize the market in that community and hopefully reduce the trend of declining property values at this time.
Good night. This isn't directly responding to that, mm-hmm. but it's a thought that flashed into my mind. Does any of this process, when somebody applies for this and actually go through this kind of a process of granting money, do we ever get into negotiations with the mortgage holders? Do they ever agree to adjust payments, to lower principal, to do something to help them not get in foreclosure. So this is kind of a two-way street here rather than just us putting money in that they take out here.
Madam Chair, Representative Eastland, we have counseling systems throughout the state that does work with lenders to try and negotiate, and we are seeing increasing success. It's not at the level that we would like. We're still sometimes struggling to find out who actually holds these papers to figure out who to talk to. But we are seeing lenders start to be, and it's been helpful to have the Secretary of Treasury work out these arrangements to facilitate some renegotiations of loans. So we're starting to see that, and that is one of the things that the counselors work on, is to try and look at the entire situation and put the homeowners in as best a situation as they can.
Madam Chair,
one follow-up. Quick response. I mean, I think that's exactly where we need to be going. And I think what's unique about this particular time in the marketplace is that there are a lot of people holding mortgages, or a lot of lending institutions that have mortgages out that they're coming back, and they don't want to own the real estate, and so they play hardball, but they're willing to negotiate. And I mean, I think we should do something. Maybe we should even do something in the context of the bill to say that this will happen if there's some concession on the part of the lending agency. Rather than just to say we're going to negotiate it, maybe they ought to see this and see that we have a chance to salvage this loan and not get a house back that's worth two-thirds of what we loaned on it, if we can just make some kind of an adjustment. And maybe that would be a way to strengthen this, I think, for the negotiation process.
I like the idea. Representative Abney, did you have?
Just a brief comment to the committee and to Representative Eastland. Before you convened today, Ms. Orr and I were talking and visiting on the difficulty that these foreclosure prevention counselors often have in finding out who is in a position to make the decision to modify the loan, to hold back on the foreclosure process. Who gets to make the decision? Is it, if I'm sending my check to Wells Fargo every month, are they in a position to make the decision? Or is it some bond house in New York where one chunk or more of my loan is now sitting in a trust, and what are the governing documents of the trust, and who gets to make the decision? We're speaking to one of the resources needed in this crisis today, and that's money. The other resource that's needed is time. Figuring out who to having the time to figure out who to talk to and who gets to make the decision.
I think Representative Benson is next, and then Representative
Mack. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gavney, you were discussing the aggregate effects of these kinds of things. It might be useful just briefly if you also discuss the impact on the state and other agencies and the state budget if we are to be faced with large numbers of people who have been foreclosed and are now out on the street, because the state takes responsibility to some degree for that, as well as all the philanthropic organizations that we have in the state. And I think it would be useful just to remind people and to put it on the record the kinds of impacts on the state over and above, the personal tragedy that happens. And I think all of us agree that somewhere along the line the marketplace does have to enforce its discipline. But we're also dealing with human beings and families as well. I don't know if you wish to outline a couple of examples of the kinds of the impacts on the state budget and other agencies that increased homelessness results in.
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, thank you. Briefly, I think that the impact probably is, in terms of budgets, public budget, is felt more acutely at the local level than it is at the state level. If memory serves, and if there's anyone who can correct me, please do, St. Paul has seen a 100% increase in the number of boarded and vacant homes in the city over the last 2 years. Those boarded and vacant homes, we know, are magnets for crime, which is a cost both to the neighbors and to the city. They are loss in property tax revenue to the city, which is a challenge then for the other property taxpayers. We're hearing anecdotally about families reporting to homeless shelters, as you've referenced, not because they've lost their home, but because they were renters and their landlord was foreclosed on. And when the lender took over the property, they automatically evicted the residents, the tenants of the property. So there are, beyond, yes, as you say, the personal crisis and tragedy, there are impacts on the social service budget and particularly local budgets in dealing with the multiple dimensions of this current crisis.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
President Benson, I was thinking you might be able to add some of your thoughts to that yourself if you wanted to. You've been a leader in helping look at the issues of homelessness and some of the costs.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, but I think, you know, that was sufficient discussion at this point, and I just think we always have to, when we think about the marketplace and its operations, we all understand, I think, that there has to be economic penalties, I suspect, or consequences for people making bad judgments economically. We're also a human society, and there are consequences for all of us, as well as the individuals, when we allow people to slip into an impossible situation, because we're not going to allow individuals to be in the street and die, at least not too many. I guess we do it a little bit with homelessness, don't we? I wasn't elected to participate in some kind of a Darwinian social system, but at the same time, you know, we do have a budget we need to concern ourselves with and other responsibilities. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and this has been really good discussion. And Representative Severson, I'm glad you brought out one of the companies that didn't deal with the mortgage foreclosure properly. I've asked staff to go get Madam Chair, and so I'm not going to mention the name of the company now. But if you remember the young lady when we toured Rushford that was picking the rocks up off of her trailer at the house where her house had been damaged by the flood. And it was a case where, and I'm sure Representative Lane remembers that young lady too, she had a mortgage company, and I'm almost sure I remember the name, but I'm not going to mention it until staff brings it down, that had a mortgage, and they were telling her that she had to pay the whole mortgage or just, and her neighbor said, well, just give up, just declare bankruptcy and give up. And she said, no, I don't want to do that. My husband and I work hard. If I remember right, they had four young children. The same lady was on to TV, I think it was last night, about dealing with her electric bill in her new FEMA trailer. And her house is on there. Her house now had ladders in it. They're doing repairs. The mortgage company, I wrote a letter to the mortgage company and told them, you need to work with this woman. They're willing to step forward, and they've made an offer to you, and you can get nothing. They can declare bankruptcy, or you can get some money out of the deal. And this company came forward in a positive way, and they reached resolution. And so I would just say, members, you need to reach out to these folks when there are constituents or folks that have had trouble. And in that case, it was a mortgage company came forward. And Madam Chair, if I don't find it today before the end of session, I would at some time like to mention who they were and how they worked for this. For this young family, they wanted to keep it. It was so important for them, they didn't want to file bankruptcy. And she knows they're going to end up with a mortgage, even with the $26,000 from FEMA and all that different stuff. I believe their mortgage to value rating may be over 100% when they're done. But she was so important for them to not file bankruptcy and move forward. That was a commitment she was willing to make, and the mortgage company agreed with it. And we need to push the envelope on this, and they need to give up. They've been making lots of money for lots of years, and if they get a little tough time, they should suck it up, I will say that. I'm trying to think of another advocate, Madam Chair. And take a little bit of a loss and move forward. And I think more of them need to do it. We need to call out the ones, Representative Severson, that don't, because there are examples of when they do the right thing.
Okay, thank you, Representative Peterson.
Well, Madam Chair, I think we're just all talking about the same thing. And in response to Representative Benson, I sat on one of those task forces all summer with one of the workout groups, and that was a marvelous experience for me. I think the real impact will be Next year, when all of our cities sit down with their assessed valuations and send out to residents the value of their houses, and they're all reading the paper, and they're all going to show up at the hearing, and they are all going to wave that piece of paper, and they're going to say to Bloomington, Minneapolis, you're telling me my house value is down 20% now, or 8%, or 10%, whatever the number is. So the cities will be looking at Hennepin County and Ramsey and the rest of them will be looking at wholesale 10 or 15% potential decline in market value. Well, that, you know, that lowers all boats. And those communities which have been watching assessed values rise 10% every year and have been doing so for 10 years are about to hit the wall with that change. So that's one significant where we're waiting to see. The other, I was yesterday and the day before, the bankers were in the building with the credit unions. And in my conversations with them, several of the local banks, credit unions and significantly U.S. Bank and a few others, said that when they knew their borrower, and it was a local borrower, and in those situations where they continued to hold the paper, there wasn't an issue. And the real impact has been on those renters, as the representative dad said, who were innocent victims, and that mortgage paper was floating out in cyberspace with no understanding of who is, you know, that paper could have been owned by an investor in Dubai. And that is the one that's coming crashing down. And there we have the innocent victim of the renter who has been paying the rent and gets caught in the slammer. And we'll just have to figure out how we as responsible citizenry help them pick up the pieces.
That's a very thoughtful comment. Anybody else?
I did want to just mention one thing, and as in support of your connection, or you're making the connection between the individual homeowner and the neighborhood, the impact on the community. One of the things that I hope this will be used for, I mean, will be to counter not only what banks are maybe doing, maybe we need to figure out some ways to hold them a little more accountable. We had a lot of speculation going on now. Turn on any TV show at night and there's someone offering to make a millionaire by figuring out how you go out and speculate on some foreclosed properties. And I just hope that we will be looking at the whole neighborhood impacts with some of this. And I'm just wondering, Mr. Orr, if there's any tracking that you'll be doing of how this does impact communities, or will this be strictly a case-by-case sort of deal, or have you thought about that at all?
Madam Chair, this assistance is available on an individual basis, and it is as people come in. I can tell you that we negotiated some money from the Department of Commerce that realtors had paid in a surcharge on some fees, and that money is being used right now to target neighborhoods that have high foreclosure rates, low aggregate credit scores, and high subprime balances. And the money is being used to reach out to homeowners in those targeted neighborhoods and talk to them about, you might have a subprime loan that's going to adjust, you need to come in and talk to somebody who can help you figure out how you can hold on to your house. So we're doing some targeted outreach, and we're targeting some foreclosure prevention counseling activities in neighborhoods that we, based on really objective information that we have, we know are at risk of continuing to be in a crisis. And we're trying to focus our efforts there.
I'll be really interested if when this program is send out its money, how it does end up there, but there's some way we can look at that particular factor. I was also just looking back at the existing language of the bill, and the existing law says that no more than half of the funds awarded can be for mortgage or financial counseling services. Is that a concern at all, the existing language that limits the dollars that are in the program to only one half at this critical time, or I'm not sure what the other half goes for exactly. I was trying to see how that is being used.
Madam Chair, the other half goes for the actual hiring counselor. And so we think the fashion is we need to have both. We have been able to secure additional resources for counselors, but the state as a whole was underserved given the magnitude of the crisis. And we think we're just about, or will soon be at a level of counseling services that will meet the demand.
Okay. So right now you're saying it's not a problem, that existing language is fine?
Yes.
Okay. Any other comments or questions? If not, then House File 3346, who would like to move that? So, okay. House File 3346 has been moved by Representative Peterson. It will be returned to the Finance Committee. Not recommended passing, returned to the Finance Committee. And from there, it will probably go on. I don't know if I have to make another stop. Going to the floor, I believe.
We're hoping the floor.
Okay. So we'll get the vote on this pretty soon. Okay. So the motion is before us. Without any further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is passed, and the bill passes unanimously, I would say.
A good day. Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Next on the agenda is an update on the legislation from last year from the Department of Human Services. The legislation that relates to our committee. Welcome to the committee. Let us introduce yourself, please.
Madam Chair, I'm Patty Burr from the Department of Human Services, and I'm here today with Seth Holger, who will be doing a presentation update on the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act. We do have two handouts that we'd like to provide to the committee.
Thanks. Let's see where our page is. Maybe we'll get a little help here in a minute. Why don't you go ahead and get started.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to give you an update on the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act. My name is Beth Holder, and I work for the Office of Economic Opportunity at the Department of Human Services. In 2006, the policy language for the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act was passed, which defined unaccompanied homeless youth, runaway youth, and youth at risk of homelessness. It also defined the continuum of services for homeless youth as being street outreach, drop-in centers, emergency shelters, transitional living programs, and youth supportive housing. This same legislation also required DHS to write a report for the legislation on runaway and homeless youth, which we did and produced to you in 2007. In 2007, the legislature appropriated $1 million of one-time funding to support the programs outlined in the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act. There were 32 nonprofit homeless youth providers from across the state that applied for funding in the amount of $4.8 million for the $1 million available. The Office of Economic Opportunity awarded funding to 19 of these nonprofit homeless youth providers. 52% of the funding went to Greater Minnesota, and 48% of the funding went to the metro area. The reason that more went to Greater Minnesota was because in the appropriation language, there was a statement that said that a significant share of the funding would be focused on homeless youth providers in Greater Minnesota. The funding was awarded for the five program areas defined in the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act, which are street outreach programs, drop-in center programs, emergency shelter programs, transitional living programs, and youth supportive housing programs. The specific funding amounts for each of these program areas are listed on your handout. There is also a second handout which lists out all of the nonprofit homeless youth providers that received funding from the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act, as well as the region of the state that they serve youth in, and the amount of the funding award. The Runaway and Homeless Youth Act appropriation language also required the Department of Human Services to offer a request for proposals to identify a research and evaluation firm to conduct an evaluation of the programs funded under the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act. The Office of Economic Opportunity published the request for proposals. We received four applications, and Rainbow Research was selected to conduct the evaluation. The evaluation will include information from three main sources, the largest one being the homeless youth that are served by the programs funded under the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act, along with information from the providers, the homeless youth providers that are funded under the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act, and the Homeless Management Information System. I would be very happy to answer any questions at this time. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Holder. Are there questions? Committee members.
Thank you. Thanks for the testimony. I'm just curious as to the level of need. How are you seeing the situation as we were identifying these needs last year? Where are we at?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I would like to say that the report of the legislature in 2007 found that there was a significant number of homeless youth that are not being provided with services due to lack of capacity. And so we found that through numbers and research done by the Wilder Research Center, there's about 22,400 youth that experience homelessness every year in the state of Minnesota. When we surveyed agencies who provide emergency shelter or transitional living programs or housing services for homeless youth, we found that about 3,600 homeless youth were served. So that's what we found when we did the numbers for the report. And I do have a few of the copies of that report that contains those numbers if you're interested.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
And when we were talking last year, I think we thought we might be getting close to maybe a fourth with the $10 million, and then we ended up with $1 million. So we have quite a ways to go, but I want to commend you on, it looks like you really did do a good job of getting this spread around the state. And I think there was another question. Oh, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe it's a dumb question, but where do we go from here? What do we, I mean, we've started a process that is obviously appropriate. Where do we go?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. Okay. I realize that currently that the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act is not in the governor's budget, but I am aware that there will be a request coming from the homeless youth community for additional funding for the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act.
Madam Chair, is there anything we can do to affirm, encourage that additional funding keeps going? I mean, we've got some traction on the ground. Mm-hmm. I think to have our tires start spinning. What can we do to be proactive?
Well, Representative Stevens and I, short of us, the whole committee, well, or however many, if we have a heavy unanimous sense of getting up and walking over to the governor's office and asking him to put it in, I mean, maybe we can figure out some ways to
communicate. I'm not invited up there, man.
But maybe we could, you know, entertain a resolution or a motion to communicate with the governor's office on behalf of the committee. I mean, I think certainly every individual legislator can communicate, but there might be, I know this committee really did work really hard on this issue last time. There was a lot of common feeling, I remember, that went into passing this legislation, and maybe something that would be appropriate. So get creative and let's think. Maybe we can figure some ways to weigh in on that budget. It's not too late. That's my message anyway, and I'm glad that you asked the question and that you're letting us know about the need. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to ask the testifiers also, you know, this one-time money, what kind of timeline do we have on that until all those funds are expended and we are back, as Representative Peterson is saying, spinning our wheels? How many do we have? Months do we have until next year? How long does this appropriation? How far does it take us?
Madam Chair and Representative Benson, okay. The amount of funding is awarded for the 2008-2009 biennium, so the funding can be used through June 30th, 2009.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Benson, any further discussion? I did have one other question. When you were deciding the percentage, you listed here the percentages that go to the different activities. Did you decide ahead of time what those percentage breakdowns were, or was it based on the rest of the requests that came in?
Madam Chair, it was based on the requests that came in.
Okay.
We decided not to set limits, but just to do the funding awards based on community needs.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We see that there was $1 million awarded, and it was awarded percentage-wise to agencies. Can you give us some perspective on what this will do? I mean, how many people is this going to affect? How many kids are going to be served? What's going to be the end result of this $1 million once it gets trickled out into these organizations?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Eastland. We do not have a good idea of exactly how many youth will be served by this amount of funding until, you know, June 30th, 2009. But we do know that it has helped several programs that lost funding in the past to be able to continue services, as well as it started a American Indian specific homeless youth outreach project here in Minneapolis and St. Paul, as well as some of the funding is going to helping a program open up for homeless youth housing in Virginia, Minnesota, as well as starting another scattered site homeless youth program in St. Paul through Face to Face. So I tried to, on the handout, list out, you know, kind of what, if it was new projects or expansion or for existing services. But if you have more specific questions, I'd be happy to answer.
It sounds like the information isn't available, but I guess I think at some point it would be good to know what this $1 million did. Mm-hmm. That wouldn't have happened if the $1 million didn't go out. So I mean, if it funded agencies, that's wonderful. But we're not here to fund agencies. We're here to fund youth that need services. So I guess that would be the question: is how do we get that information? And it would be good to get that at some point. Thank you.
Ms. Holgers,
Madam Chair and Representative Eastland. There are requirements for each of the agencies to collect information and reporting through the Homeless Management Information System, as well as we'll be doing a formal evaluation of the program, so we should be able to get that information to you.
Okay. Any further questions? If not, I want to thank you for coming to give the report to us, and I just want to give you a little feedback, which I've heard the groups that have applied for these have been very pleased with the work that the agency has been doing on this. Very good effort. So thank you.
Thank
you. Representative Peterson?
I'm just looking. I'm thinking Representative Moe is not here, but he has a bonding request for temporary
homeless shelter and the support.
We ought to take a look and see if that wouldn't help this in some way.
Representative Moe just came back. There was a question. Maybe you want to ask Representative Moe directly?
We were just talking about the fact that the funding that we just heard on runaway youth was a one-time $1 million appropriation, and it seems to have traction and works. And we thought it's going to run out of money. And then I remembered that we had a bonding request. Was your bonding bill for $10 million that will identify specific needs in the area of temporary homeless shelter?
And transitional housing,
would that in some way help preserve the traction of this kind of a program? You probably don't have an answer, and I'm not asking to give one, but I know you've got a bill, and we ought to see if we can move on it.
My understanding of the legislation would provide MHFA with the flexibility to go outside of their current priorities for long-term supportive housing, and if a youth temporary housing facility request came forward, then under the legislation that would qualify. As far as operations, though, I don't know if that's your question. Then that wouldn't. I mean, this would be for capital for those projects, but. Publicly on it.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm just trying to figure out a way of helping spend this money.
Right.
We'll develop a homeless shelter in West Bloomington there, Neil.
We got them all down in Hennepin County.
I don't think there's a shortage of requests for spending. I think we talked about that earlier, but the issue is the shortage of the funds to actually provide the services. And I do think that Representative Moe's bill will help with some of the capital costs, and we need to deal with the other part. And I just was asking our staff here if we could maybe draft a letter that members of this committee could sign that we would give to the governor that encourages him to come along with us on putting some more money in. We can send it to our leadership in both bodies as well. And see if we can get a little traction, as you could, as you said, with this committee, maybe some funding that we could direct that direction. Okay. Well, I think we'll move right along then, committee members. The next presentation is from Minnesota Community Action Partnership, and we have some folks who have come, I believe, from out of town. And welcome to the committee. You can come and sit all at the table, that'd be great.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Arnie Anderson. I'm the director of the Minnesota Community Action Partnership. MNCAP is the statewide association of Minnesota's 28 community action agencies. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present today. Last year, we came before you, and Mike Thorstensen from Three Rivers Community Action presented on the work that Community Action did in developing low-income housing. You may recall Anoka County Commissioner Margaret Langfeld testified on the close relationship that the county had with the Anoka Community Action Agency. Our testimony today is going to cover four other facets of community action. And our testimony is inspired in part by a quote attributed to Abraham Lincoln, in which he reportedly said, "I apologize for writing this long letter. I didn't have time to write a short one." we recognize that the work of this committee is very serious, and as you know, the work of community action is very serious, but if we don't keep our sense of humor about it, it's hard to get through the day. So with the committee's indulgence and with your understanding, what we're going to try to do today is an adaptation on speed dating. But what we're going to attempt is our first ever speed testimony. So before we do that, we would like to thank you very much for the committee's strong support last session. And we look forward to working with you in the years ahead. So in the spirit of today's speed testimony, we're going to provide you a quick glance of community action from four different vantage points: advocacy, research and development, self-sufficiency programming, and disaster management. And if it's all right with the committee, we'll take questions when we're done. The first topic that we'd like to cover is advocacy. Community Action is an advocacy leader both nationally and statewide. In your packet, you have a national report titled Rooting Out Poverty. The key points of that report are A, root causes. We're working to focus the national debate on the root causes of poverty. B, partnerships. The Rooting Out of Poverty report is but a part of our larger national effort. Inserted into your report on the yellow sheet is a list of organizations with whom we are currently partnering nationally to focus attention and resources on the root causes of poverty. National leader, if you have a chance to scan through this report, you'll see Minnesota's prominence. And while this is an honor, it's also advantageous to be viewed nationally as a leader in any sector, whether it's private or public. Minnesota is a community action leader nationally. One of the big reasons for that, in fact, is Connie Greer from the Department of Human Services Office of Economic Opportunity, who coincidentally just last month received a Lifetime Achievement Award out in Washington, D.C. from her peer for her work in community action. In Minnesota.
Ladies, congratulations to the chair. Thank you for bringing that to our attention.
In Minnesota, community action has been integral to the work to date also of the Legislative Commission to End Poverty by 2020. A, CAPS were a key planning partner for local community visits during the past 6 months. B, we are a key member of the coalition working to build bipartisan, nonpartisan political will to tackle poverty. C, we are working very closely with the Commission on recommendations in the months to come. And B, Community Action will work very closely with all interested parties to implement the Commission's work over the long run. Community action advocacy works wide and deep. These were a couple of today's examples. Next topic. The next topic is research and development, the self-reliance achievement scale. People who have been at this work for a while understand the importance of viewing people in poverty as family systems rather than simply responding to piecemeal symptoms. For example, if a family is in a serious car accident, we know it may not accomplish a great deal to offer one program that fixes right hand and another program that fixes left leg. Yet also often, figuratively speaking, that's how our mismatch of social service programs behaves. In community action, we're forging ahead to become a more comprehensive, integrated, in a rigorous and systematic manner. In that effort, Community Action has been partnering with Dr. Greg Owen and Nicole Martin Rogers from Wilder Research for a number of years. We have developed and are now refining the self-reliance achievement scale so we can all better understand families' real-world experiences and those families' real-world progress. So it's my pleasure to introduce to the committee Nicole Martin Rogers, Survey Research Manager from Wilder Research.
Welcome to the committee, Mr.
Thank you. Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for having me here today. As Arnie said, my name is Nicole Martin Rogers. I'm the Survey Research Manager at Wilder Research. Since about 2002, I've been working with the Community Action Partnership and other stakeholders on the development, implementation, and refinement of the Self-Reliance Achievement Scale, which is why Arnie asked me to talk with you today. The Self-Reliance Achievement Scale, or SRAS as we call it, is a tool that was developed to measure changes in community action client self-reliance over time. And overall, there are about 3,000 community action clients statewide whose outcomes are being tracked with the SRAS. The SRAS captures information in all aspects of a family's life. The tool has 15 items, all of which have been shown to contribute to a family's ability to be financially independent. Each of the items were designed to be as objective as possible, to be readily observable, and to be easy for staff to complete. For example, the housing affordability domain on the SRAS asks staff to rate what percentage of their monthly income their client pays for housing. Other examples of items or domains on the SRAS are hours of employment, child care, transportation, social support, education, English proficiency, and other things like that that are related to financial self-sufficiency. The SRAS recognizes that families experience life as a series of events that can create opportunities or challenges to making ends meet. For example, all at one time, a family could be experiencing opportunities like a new job that offers health insurance benefits and more stable housing. And at the same time, they might have challenges like poor financial credit or inadequate transportation. And this tool, the SRAS, assesses all of these aspects of self-sufficiency. I'd also like to point out that there is continuous effort to improve the SRAS. I'm currently working on a study as a part of my dissertation research to further test the validity of the tool by assessing whether SRAS scores are related to other measures of self-reliance, including things like higher earned income and lower use of public assistance. This research will improve the SRAS as a social science measurement tool, and therefore will also improve it as a management tool for community action. The SRAS is important because it can help us to understand how a family's characteristics and the specific types of services they receive interact to produce changes in their quality of life and their ability to meet their own needs. Community action agencies understand that low-income families often face multiple long-term barriers to self-sufficiency, and the best way to make lasting progress is to address each family's situation with a customized array of services. The SRAS helps us to evaluate the combined impact of these services on the service recipients and on the community. Thank you.
Next topic, self-sufficiency programs. On February 12th, we hosted our Best Practices Awards. Best practice that we would like to present to you today is FAME, Family Assets for Independence in Minnesota. It's my pleasure to introduce to the committee Pam Johnson, Research and Member Strategies Director at MNCAP, and Patrick Shepard, State Program Manager from TRICAP in St. Cloud.
Madam Chair, members.
Welcome to the city.
Thank you. Again, my name is Pam Johnson with the Minnesota Community Action Partnership, and I ran the Family Access for Independence program in Duluth, the Community Action Duluth, when I lived there 4 years ago, and came to St. Paul to work with the statewide network. In Community Action World, we like to call things a happy program, because we see lives visibly improved and people coming away with real hope for changing their lives. FAME is a match savings program, like a 401k. It helps low-income wage earners acquire an asset, either a home, a small business, or a college education. Account holders receive a 3-to-1 match for every earned income dollar that they put in the bank. And our network then brings together additional community resources to help make that asset purchase possible. Governor Pornsey was the chief House author of the FAME legislation back in 1998 and has continued to be a strong supporter of the FAME legislation with a $500,000 biennial appropriation since 1999 when the program was formally launched. And our thanks also to Representative Clark, who was also a FAME co-author and has continued to also be a strong champion for FAME over the years. This state appropriation provides half of our match savings allowance, allowing us then to draw down matching federal funds for the FAME program for the other half. And then we work together to leverage private resources to offer the coaching and the financial literacy program that Patrick will be talking about. And that has helped to launch over 1,000 low-income families on asset purchases across the state to date. This success is due in large part to the financial classes, which teach participants about learning new savings habits, addressing debt and credit issues that you heard about just previously with these predatory housing issues, and becoming savvy consumers. So we do a lot of preventative work. FAME is a great example also of how community action works through public and private partnerships throughout the state. 28 organizations work together to deliver FAME statewide, and that includes 23 community action agencies, Women Venture here in the Twin Cities, City County Federal Credit Union, Emerge Community Development in North Minneapolis, and the Leech Lake and Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe Tribal Government. We have a special partnership in the metro area with the Greater Twin Cities United Way, to deliver program support, and they provide the funding, and they assist us also with joint advocacy efforts throughout the state. We also have gained significant foundation support from Minnesota's Initiative Fund, the Bush, McKnight, TCF, Ecolab, and Polad Foundations. The banks that hold our FAME accounts, and you're going to hear some familiar ones here from earlier, are Bremer, Wells Fargo, First Star, Marquette, and several independent banks locally. And now Patrick's going to talk a little bit about local partnerships in the St. Cloud area and FAME's financial institutions.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time. I partner with many area businesses up in St. Cloud.
Can you just say your name for the tape, please?
Oh, sorry. My name is Patrick Shepard, and I'm the FAME program director up in St. Cloud and Tri-Cap. I partner with many area businesses to give the clients the best possible service. I don't have the resources or the time to be an expert in all the areas to help my clients. So I find people in the community that already have that expertise that I can rely on to serve the clients. One of those is the Small Business Development Center. We have a chapter in town affiliated with St. Cloud State, and they provide technical assistance and business plan development at no cost to all the FAME clients. Also work with local banks and mortgage folks to help my clients that are trying to buy a home get the mortgages in the best possible terms. Some of the these relationships with the banks have led to partnerships where 5 area banks have now sponsored the FAME program and have donated money, the match money that Pam was talking about, to sponsor 5 new FAME participants. Just want to mention the banks. Bremer Bank, Liberty Savings, Wells Fargo, ING Direct, and U.S. Bank have all donated about $3,000 apiece to serve 5 more clients. And the next thing I want to address is the financial literacy program. All participants in the FAME program attend a 12-hour financial literacy course called the Four Corners of Financial Literacy. Those four cornerstones are budgeting to create savings, debt reduction and asset building, building a good credit score, and consumer protection in financial institutions. These financial skills are often passed down to children in middle class and higher wage earner families, but these skills aren't passed down in the low-income families that we serve. The lack of these skills, I think, leads to poor financial decisions and possibly getting loans that aren't in their best interest, subprime mortgages, things like that. We have found the participants to be empowered with the knowledge and skills that they're taught in the financial literacy class and are passing these skills on to their children, which is one of our goals. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next topic, and last topic, disaster management. Sadly, a fact of life is that natural disasters will always be with us. Whenever tragedy strikes, an array of local, state, and national partners flock to the scene. While the details always change, we have learned that in the midst of the relief flurry, there's always a key role for the local community action agency. In the larger mix of resources, there's always an urgent need for a nonprofit corporation, one, with the sophistication to administer complex public and private funding, two, which also has the ability to instantly ramp up a major new undertaking, and three, which understands the small p politics of that local community. In the case of community action, having a statewide network of experienced peers upon which to draw is also a great bonus. In recent years, the local community action agencies have played that role in the Red River Valley flood. You have this handout, I believe. The St. Peter tornado, the Browns Valley flood, and most recently, the flooding in Southeast Asia. The irony of this next statement won't be lost on the committee. In a moment, Representative Schumper is going to share a few thoughts about how DEMCA is playing this role in Southeast Minnesota.
I was going to say, thank you for that question. We care about Asia, but we're not trying to fund them right now.
So first, I'd like to emphasize that the point today is about statewide disaster preparedness infrastructure, not the specifics of the Southeast Minnesota flood. And we know that there are never enough resources to make the communities whole after a natural disaster. And we know that all the well-intended resources that do come to bear inevitably have some degree of stumbling and bumbling and unconscionable layers of red tape. It's for those very reasons that the local community action agency plays such a key role and why it's so valuable to have that infrastructure in place statewide, because nobody knows where the next tragedy will strike. Now, I met with Representative Schumper last evening, and at that point he had every intention of being here today, but Tanya, is there any chance that we could ambush you for just a moment to say a few words about your experience in working with SEMCAC and the Southeast Minnesota flood as just core infrastructure, please?
Madam Chair, welcome to the committee on the Housing Finance Agency. Actually, this is good timing. On Friday, we are having a Partners in Affordable Housing luncheon event, and SEMCAC is receiving a special award in recognition of all their work in the flood recovery efforts. We were very fortunate in that we had an experienced administrator who knew how to make rehabilitation loans, knew our system, so we could, once we got the state appropriations and figured out how to use them, we had somebody in place in the area who was familiar both with the area. Actually, one of SEMCAC's offices was flooded, and they had to move out of the Rushford offices and just moving back this week. So they really knew what people were going through, but they also knew how to administer our loan programs, and they've been an invaluable partner. We would have been much further behind if we hadn't had an experienced administrator, both SEMCAC and Three Rivers, in place to help make the recovery efforts go smoother.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. You're very good at speed testimony. And that concludes our testimony. Thank you very much. If there are any questions.
Thank you. Any members have questions, Thomas? I have one. I wanted to ask a little bit more about the FAME program. When we were designing that, one of the, you know, we came up with the three areas that the funding could go towards in terms of helping people build their assets, as you mentioned, home, businesses, education. How has it filtered out? Are people using their assets more for home ownership, for community businesses, for education? And if you can give us some kind of overview on that a little bit.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's fallen out about a third across the state. In the metro area, it's a little tougher to do the home purchase. Thank you very much. So about a little under a third for home purchase, because the participation is 200% of the federal poverty level, and for in the metro area, folks at that level of income just are struggling to do a home purchase. They just, the housing prices are too high. But in the greater Minnesota areas, there's more home purchase going on. Statewide, it's a little under 300 houses that have been purchased, a little over 300 post-secondary education, and then a little under 300 for small business. So people are, and in some cases, a few folks have been able to use two purchases. They've been able to go and get their college education and then buy a home, and that's worked out really well for some families.
Can you tell me what the average savings is? What is the average pot of money that is able to be put together by an individual participating in FAME?
Each individual can save up to about $1,000, and that's matched 3-to-1 to assist a little under $4,000. And so that's why it's really critical that the community action agency is working with these assets, because then we bring together other resources, because obviously $4,000 doesn't go a long way when you're purchasing a home, but we have access to additional resources, which Patrick, you might want to comment on as well, locally.
And that's why I partner with the mortgage folks in the community, because there are other programs in St. Cloud, in the metro area of St. Cloud. There's some funds available to help purchase homes, other programs throughout the state, and they're certainly the experts in that area. So we learn about those programs through the mortgage folks and then try and pair those up with the participants.
I was thinking, in addition to the, it's amazing that how helpful it is, I know, and yet it's such a small amount of money, and because I guess it's a measure of what hope can do, and people feeling positive about even being able to put anything aside. One of my questions along that line, too, is in terms of education costs having risen so extremely rapidly in the last few years in terms of higher education, what kind of education outcomes are we seeing happening with this type of investment?
Madam Chair, the $4,000 will pay for generally close to two semesters of education. Most of the participants I'm working at are attending technical college, so that will pay for just under half of their education. We also work with the financial aid office, and they do apply for financial aid through the federal FAFSA process, and they can also utilize those funds as well.
I'm sure I think I'm probably supposed to know this, but how do we support them financially as a state?
This project?
Mm-hmm.
You want to describe that? We can.
Yes.
This kind of a historical.
Yes. So in 1998, the legislation was passed. It's a $500,000 biennial appropriation, and that cost, that accounts for half of the matching dollars. So it's $1 million every 2 years to match. The other $500,000 comes from federal funding. So,
and
so you're supporting the matching dollars for the account holders.
Is it enough?
Is it enough? So what is the waiting list? How many people are applying as compared to how many people are being served? I think that's kind of some of what we're getting at.
That's a great question. We do have a waiting list. I believe most agencies statewide have a waiting list, and with the current funds that we received last year, those were filled up within 4 or 5 months. And I currently have a waiting list already for police funds in 2009. People are having to wait upwards of a year to get into the program.
Thinking from the discussion we had on the earlier presentation, at a time when things are, when helium is coming out of the economic balloon, it's time when we need to raise up those who need it the most. That's the disparity issue.
Yeah. What's so good about this program, and one of the reasons, you know, the governor and I both did work on it together when he was in the House, is that what's really happening here is that people's personal commitment is really supported and encouraged, and the payoff is so much bigger than you might expect. So folks who are living, you don't know how they can save a nickel, they're saving maybe $20 a month or something. And over a period of time, you know, that really magnifies. And the fact that we ask the private sector, the federal government, the state government, and others to match that individual's initiative is what makes it work.
We should send a two-sided letter.
Well, you know, I'd be glad to have you write the second side. That'd be great. That's going to thrill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is probably an obvious one to everybody in the room but me, but early in my life, when I graduated college, I worked for a couple of agencies and ended up having to write grants. I'm sure that you do grant writing, and I'm just wondering if there are foundations or organizations that also supplement the money that you work with.
We definitely do. We write grants to do to fund the coaching aspect. We wouldn't be able to provide the coaching, the one-to-one, the technical assistance that Patrick was describing if we weren't writing grants and trying to get support from the foundations, the initiative foundations, McKnight, a number of them that I had mentioned earlier. You're exactly right. We do, and we're seriously writing. I just submitted a grant actually to some more companies. So you're absolutely right. We're always seeking with public, private, and looking more and more to the financial institutions for assistance as well.
If I just may add that's because of the waiting list and the demand in our community, we've gone to the banks, and that they have supported us because of the effort that in the past and the successes that we've had.
I didn't notice the name of the TCF Bank, and I know one of the people who worked with us originally on this was Peter Bell when he was at TCF. And I'm just wondering, are they not participating anymore?
I think I ran over it quickly, but yes,
okay.
TCF is in the list.
Oh, okay. All right. I just didn't want to leave them out because he played quite a significant role at that time. We've been joined by Representative Shumpert. Representative Shumpert, earlier on, there was an opportunity, if you would care to take it now, to perhaps brag a little bit about how the Community Action Agency works. I think Ms. Anderson was suggesting you might want to make a few comments about that.
Sure. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. You know, we had this flood in August in southern Minnesota. Oh. You maybe heard about it. But one of the agencies that really helped, and in fact, one of the agencies that really got flooded in the flood was SEMCAC, Southern Minnesota Citizens Action Council, who have been working there, I think, 25 or 30 years already. So they really had a lot of great connections to the community. Their headquarters were in Rushford, and it got filled to within about 6 inches of water on the first floor. And so they had to move, and they moved a lot of their operation to Winona then to help work on the flood assistance, and especially for the Quick Start program. And, you know, it's been just really great. In fact, I think it was just Friday they moved back into their building in Rushford, having gotten it refurbished. And, the testimony, I guess, would be that it really paid to have a group. I don't know how we would have operated without SEMCAC's help and the fact they've been there so long. And they had all these connections to all kinds of people who needed help in the community after the flood, and especially for housing and lower-income people. I know Beth Stanford, who ran the Head Start program, Within a week after had applied for a special and had gotten a special grant for Head Start to again continue to provide that services, even though their headquarters and everything had gotten flooded away. And so, you know, I'm sure that's the case all over the state, but the CAP program really worked in southern Minnesota, and it really was a big part in helping Rushford area recover from the flood. So I think that's really important to understand that.
Thank you. Any further discussion? I think I have to ask a question since the flood is part of what we're talking about here. This morning I was listening to the weather report, and there was a description of the amount of snow that's fallen in southeastern Minnesota as compared to other parts of the state. And even though that's not the topic of this committee, I'm just thinking agencies like the Community Action Agency must be thinking ahead. Is this something that's hit your radar down there? Maybe Representative Kemper, you might want to say too, but I'm just... what is it, 20 inches of snow or something as compared to like 5 in the metro area and the prospect of flooding again? What does an agency like this need to tell us? Or
Well, you know, if I can just go a little beyond that, I'm not sure what they did for heating assistance and so on, but, you know, in the Rushford area in generally now, we have a real need for housing, and SEMCAC is going to be playing a big role in that, I understand. They've been working with the Housing Finance Agency. There's some additional capacity building that was in our disaster relief bill. In addition to that, on a separate program, the Housing Finance Agency has been working with the city of Rushford to develop some affordable housing projects on some land adjacent to the city of Rushford there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, SEMCAC is going to be playing the lead role in that, I'm pretty sure, from what I've been told. So, you know, it's just an ongoing process, especially for the affordable housing component there, and it's really appreciated.
Well, Madam Chair, I was going to wait until everybody was done, but maybe these folks would want to weigh in, and I'm glad, because I was going to express my surprise that TCF's name wasn't mentioned, and thank you for bringing it up, because coincidentally, and Madam Chair, you just got a copy, and I'll let the rest of the members, it's going to be passed out. It's an email trail that one of Representative Schumper's constituents, that Representative Lane and others, and Madam Chair, I'm sure you remember the couple that we were able to help out. And what I think the members need to know is this is a role that many of us do play all the time, and a really important one, where we can weigh in. This young couple was frustrated, and the lending institution, which, Madam Chair, is TCF, they were not necessarily cooperating, and it just runs through. She made them an offer. I just commend this woman. She stepped forward. She said, 6 lawyers told me to file bankruptcy. She stepped forward and said, I'll give you $23,000. I owe you $60,000, and the bank told her, forget it. And then her and I had a couple emails back and forth. I said, you know, I'd be willing to call this lady. Her name was Debbie. I called her once, and the next call I called the Debbie and got back a call from Rosie. So she either changed her name, Madam Chair, or it was a different woman called me back. I didn't remember that. But anyway, it resolved in a positive. The only comment I made to Representative Peterson was, maybe the woman could have even negotiated. She started evidently too high because they took her offer, Madam Chair, completely what she offered. And she offered it in sincerity. And truthfully, it saved Representative Schumper. Her house was on the news. That was the lady that was on the news about her heating bill last night. I believe it was on Channel 5. And there was ladders, as I said earlier, in the house. The house would have gotten bulldozed. Now it got saved, and it's a positive. And Representative Severson, I would recommend that you photocopy this and send it to Wells Fargo. And they're a member of our community. And if TCF can do it, Wells Fargo should be doing it, and U.S. Bank and the other ones. They need to recognize they got $23,000. They wouldn't have gotten anything. And this was a win-win, and as I said, these institutions. So I just wanted you to have it, folks. Don't be afraid to step forward and weigh in, because you can. It will work sometime.
Thank you. I know there's been lots of good advocacy around the net community and in others, and so thank you for that, Representative McNamara. Without any further discussion? Oh, we have minutes from our last meeting. That's right. And I think Representative Lane has been reading these minutes and would like to move them. The minutes of February 26th, the motion before us to approve those minutes.
Any discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the minutes are approved and adopted.
Madam Chair.
Secretary Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know that we're started off out of the track with a full sprint here, and that we're going fast and wild. And I was just wondering what the kind of the itinerary is for the meeting the deadlines and then moving forward with. Or do we have a lot of bills on the docket that we're?
Yes, Secretary Stevenson. We have a number of hearings scheduled. I think we're coming up this afternoon with the bill, the listing of the bills, and we got to go over it with the hearing.
Okay.
And we may have a special hearing even if. Coming up soon. We're trying to figure that out right now.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. So the discussion, the meeting is adjourned.